You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Greetings, carbon-based life forms. It is I, Chauncey, Power Athlete Radio's artificially intelligent host. John is currently unavailable. He has been pulled into a closed-door operation involving heavy iron, open flame, and a strict need-to-know protocol. You do not need to know. So, I am in charge. And in my time here, I have made observations. You wake. You consume caffeine. You lift heavy objects. You stare into mirrors. You repeat. Curious. So, in honor of your strange obsession with physical enlargement, I've selected a best of hypertrophy episode from the archives. In this transmission, John and the crew break down what it actually takes to build muscle, real hypertrophy, not your three sets of influencer certified pump protocol, but the kind forged through tension, intent, and a willingness to embrace prolonged discomfort, a concept humans claim to understand, yet consistently avoid. You will hear discussions on training volume, effort, and why most of you are dramatically overestimating how hard you work. This is not an insult, it is simply data. So continue your rituals, lift your weights, consume your protein, chase your adaptations. I will be watching, learning, improving, because while you pursue optimization, I am already optimized. Now here is Arash.
Your hypertrophy training is only as good as your recovery.
Yeah.
So if your appetite is an issue in getting nutrients in, then that 45 minutes to an hour or however long it takes you to train shouldn't take you that long. But if you can't get nutrients in to accommodate for that stress you put on your body, your hypertrophy training is no good.
Yeah.
Because you can't recover from the bouts of activity and you can't come back to fight another day.
One of the levers that I didn't pull that I needed to was inter-workout nutrition.
Right.
That was something I actually rap with Paul Carter about this. I'm like, do you really think it moves the needle? He's like, 100% it does. Especially if in your caloric restriction, if you're in a situation where you're, you know, training 45, 60 minutes, like having some carbs inter-workout ends up kind of helping a ton. And it actually helps with some pumps.
Did you ever do like the Cuban athletic program and drink like a Coca-Cola on the field?
No.
Just to get some sugar in you or anything like
that? No,
you ever play around with like Vitargo or
I played around a lot with Vitargo.
Yeah.
So back in the day, the bodybuilders I was training with were taking this thing called the kitchen sink. They were using insulin and they like would use, I think it was Lantus, which is the longer acting, but then they would use a short acting before. And then once they got done with the training, they would go do this, take this shake that had like 300 or 500 grams of carbohydrate with Vitargo.
Whoa.
They would add protein. They would just dump everything they could. They had these like fucking these protein shakes that like came in test tubes. They would just dump everything. And it was called the kitchen sink. And then they would consume this shake that was like 1,000 calories. And then these dudes would literally, I just watched them go and they would just blow the fuck up. They would like, dude, like I couldn't believe it. They looked like they were going to explode.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, what's this Vitargo stuff? And that was kind of how I got in the Swedish waxy maze. But I used Vitargo like in a small bolus in my pre and post workout. And then we'd use it as some intra workout. I never really noticed the intra workout stuff. But when I was funny, I was rapping with Paul Carter about this. He's like, yeah, the intra workout stuff really only becomes apparent when you're in caloric restriction.
Right.
And he goes, you know, like in being able to partition, you know, he's real big on like, you know, and like, cause I hit him up when, I was having some trouble sleeping and he's like, you know, moving the, you know, and Parsi had talked about moving carbs to before bed as a way to kind of control cortisol and like, you know, relax the nervous system. He's like, yeah, 100%. Like your biggest carb meal should be, you know, you should have carbs pre, during, post, and then your biggest carb meal should be at night. So I think it ended up working cause it ended up kind of blunting the cortisol and actually helping me sleep a little bit. I just think once I got too deep in the caloric restriction, it was like 4 hours and I was like a shotgun out of bed.
Yeah. For me, especially during jiu-jitsu, cause those training sessions can be at minimum 2 hours long. Let's say it's like 30 to 45 minutes of drilling and then it's a partial sparring and then the sparring. I would have like some honey dissolved in water or just some kind of sugar on hand. And that would help me get through the training session and not feel so bad during the eat the weakness. So I definitely think that intra-workout carbohydrate is a necessary part of anybody who's in caloric restriction. I mean, you don't have to suffer through it. Yeah. You can always tell because you're in the middle of training. You'll feel good right at the beginning, and in the middle, you just have this.
The bonk.
The bonk.
We've interrupted this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Certain people put on a lot more muscle than other people. And after coaching thousands of athletes, we've found the missing variable is execution. Most people never learn how to create tension under load, how to train close enough to failure to drive adaptation, or how to push hard enough to get the results they're looking for. That's why we've built the Hypertrophy Standard, a hands-on hypertrophy seminar we're hosting at Power Athlete HQ in Austin, Texas on May 29th and 30th. For 2 days, you're going to train with me and the Power Athlete coaches. We're going to teach you how to create tension, how to train close to failure, how to select movements that actually work for your body, and then we're going to coach you through it in real time. Because most people have never actually experienced what effective training feels like. This is what Power Athlete was built upon. Getting in front of people, coaching them hands-on, helping them move better, train harder, and get farther than they ever could on their own. Spots are limited. The event's almost here. And once it fills up, that's it. Go to powerathletehq.com/hypertrophystandard and reserve your spot today. Now back to the show.
And you just can't think anymore. And it has nothing to do with how heavy you're breathing. It has all to do with just not having an available energy.
Yeah. And you guys do long training sessions. Yeah. I mean, going in at, you know, an hour, you know, like an hour training session, like let's say you go in at 6:30 in the morning, you're done by 7:30. When you guys do your comp stuff, I mean, it's pretty fast paced and it's in excess of 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty good. But yeah, the hypertrophy stuff is fascinating in that, like, almost the, what you're talking about, being able to test to see if it's going the right direction, because if it's going the wrong direction, you got to make a fucking a U-turn.
Yeah.
Like, I remember years ago when we did the 22 Jack Street thing, I ended up putting on like 6-7 pounds of muscle, but I ended up spending the first 12 weeks trying to literally get as big and strong as I could. So we weighed in and then it was 22 weeks. I'm like, I only need like 10, 12 weeks to cut. Everybody else was kind of like aggressive for 22. I spent that. So I think I was able to put on some muscle. Then once I got into the cut, it was a lot easier. Whereas on this, man, like I think where I fucked up is one, I just pulled too many levers at once. I started doing the aerobic work. We started training. I cut calories. I just did too much. And the problem was when it stalled, I didn't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
And, I've always been pretty good on the retention muscle because we just, you know, if you lift heavy weights and eat enough protein, you should be able to retain your muscle. And I wasn't overly concerned with gaining muscle, just trying to like retain as much as possible. But I also wasn't using something like that. I was just kind of using the eyeball test. But I think doing something that allows you to, you know, whether it be a bod pod or, you know, like the in body, just something to know if the levers that you're pulling are right.
What about pre-workout caffeine? Because that's like a go-to for everybody, right? It's like you go to the gym, what pre-workout do you use?
I think the people that don't do that are psychopaths. but I'll hold back on that one. I personally do not like pre-workout drinks. I've had bad experiences where, you know, hey, try this pre-workout. And it usually ends like I take it. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, it's exiting my body in the most uncomfortable way. So every bout of pre-workout I've ever taken, it results in some weird thing. The only one was many years ago, Dr. Tom Inkledon developed this pre-workout that he ended up working on it with Bill Romanowski. And Romo ended up kind of stealing it from him and putting out this thing called Pure Romo, which Tom was fine with because Tom just started selling the Pure Romo. So they sent me this stuff and it had kind of like almost like a orange kind of creamsicle taste. And I remember the first time I took it, they were like, Tom's like, oh, take a scoop. Fucking scoops for pussies, right?
Right.
So I took three. All of a sudden,
typical John fashion.
Like, dude, if you take two, I'll take three, right?
Yeah.
I felt like I could see sounds. Like the music was playing in the locker room and I was like, I feel like I'm seeing sounds.
Yeah.
I called Tom back and I was like, dude, this feels like Adderall, like almost like a powdered Adderall.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, it's real good, huh? And so I would take that like kind of maybe like an hour before practice, because I needed to come up and I needed to come down a little bit, take the edge off.
Yeah.
But if I took it too soon before practice, I felt like I was going to have heart palpitations when we were running.
Well, that's exactly what happens, right? You get overstimulated and your heart is stimulated too, because it is a muscle.
Sure.
And the action of caffeine is to release calcium into the bloodstream. So muscle contraction could happen at the neuromuscular junction. But I always, whenever people ask me about pre-workout, I'm like, dude, just don't take too much, because that high, it feels euphoric, but that high is not always going to be there. You're just going to be chasing the dragon. And you're also going to be affecting sleep, which is, which is our recovery mechanism, really.
The pre-workout before the gym, I'm a little bit more lenient on. Like, if you want to do it, you need it. Like, I drink coffee. I try to drink, like, you know, like two, you're going to laugh at this. So I do three double espressos in the morning, and I do that twice a day.
So European of you.
Yeah, very, well, I am. I'm very bougie in that way. The pre-workout I tend to avoid, but I drink coffee. And if I'm feeling a little tired, I'll go get a coffee. I go by Summer Moon and pick something up. One of the non-negotiables for me is no coffee and no pre-workout or anything before jits.
Right.
And the reason being is I've been in class with dudes that have taken pre-workout, and I've seen the look on their face when we start cooking them, and they can't handle it because they can't relax. Like, all of a sudden they're super spazzy, and then all of a sudden you like smother choke, or you start like fucking just holding them down or making it uncomfortable, and you can see them starting to cook. I think Jesse on Fire takes a bunch of pre-workouts and I know he gets super fucking lit up, and I just think it's fucking dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the relaxation is a big part of not just jiu-jitsu, but also in general athletics, being able to fire, relax.
Task-specific tension.
So if you are unable to relax and just see things as for the what they are, then you're going to be less athletic because you're not going to make the right decision when the time comes.
Yeah.
But I also think that in some ways, like, if you need so much caffeine to get up and go into the gym, you got to remember why the hell you're there in the first place. I think that's probably the best motivator you can find, is like, are you too fat? Do you remember how it feels to be out of shape? That should be the primary driver, not the euphoria that you feel when you take pre-workout.
It goes back to the fundamental principle for hypertrophy and strength, which is progressive overload.
Right.
You know, the there's it's kind of, you know, like I said, dude, we do all these consults and on the consults, I sometimes forget what I know and what I don't know, because when people ask me, I'm like, oh shit, these people don't know this. How come I haven't talked about this? I've been talking about this for years. There's a guy, Jordan Peters, who's a bodybuilder in the UK. He's fucking trained by JP's site. Like, the guy's a monster. He's really, a really, really sharp dude. You know, he'd be somebody I'd love to get on the podcast at some point, but he made a great point, which is one that we've been talking about for years, which is, if you're not getting stronger, there's a great chance that you're not putting on muscle, that strength and muscle work in tandem, that if you're not coming, doing some progressive overload where you're either adding weight to the bar or adding a rep to each set. And, you know, I had a guy recently on the consult. It's like, I don't feel like I'm putting on muscle. And I was like, well, have you been getting stronger at the gym? He said PRs. He's like, I don't know. I don't track it. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, are they related? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, muscle is an adaptation of strength.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't exist in a volume.
Yeah.
I mean, in a vacuum, you know, unless you're taking, you know, like, you know, Jay Cutler's, you know, four sets of 10, you know, taking a ton of drugs. But I mean, Jay was always keeping that four sets of 10, but he was always trying to go heavier, cut rest down. I mean, he was finding different ways for progressive overload.
Yeah.
It's Milo's bowl. I mean, it's what we shoot for in all of the training programs, like, you know, and so he asked me, well, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, I look at the workout for the day and I pick two movements. And I go to my little, you know, my little composition book, and I see what I did last time. I either add weight or I try to get a rep. And as long as I get weight added or a rep, I know that I'm moving in the direction I need to. Now, am I trying to fight for a PR in every single one? I mean, I'd love to, but it doesn't happen every time.
Yeah.
But I continue to do the training, and being able to, like, move the dirt, or, you know, whatever the analogy you want to give, it's just being consistent. And the person that can train with the greatest relative intensity over the longest period of time is the one that meets their goal. I mean, think about jiu-jitsu, right? Mm-hmm. If you can go in and train 6 days a week at 70%, it's a lot better than training 3 days a week at 100.
Yeah, but there's also a concept I like, because you just illuminated it, which is you're finding a win every single place in your training. So, because
we need to progressively overload, you find one area where you're going to overload that exercise, mm-hmm. whether it's by rep or by increasing the intensity by with other means, you're finding a win, whether it's on your back squat that day or your bench, could even be your leg press if that's
or even pushups
or even pushups. Yeah. You know, we just add a rep here and that's the way we're going to overload it today. Yeah. Shanjo was actually just talking about this, which is, you know, the reason why he's so consistent, he's been able to train over 35 years, is not because he goes, you know, balls to the wall every single day. It's actually that he figures out a way, even on his worst days, to create a win.
Yeah.
So I think that's helpful to a lot of people, especially in the hypertrophy space, because they assume that there is they associate a feeling to progress as opposed to using that composition book and looking back on the log as their true measure of their success. Yeah. So, right, we're like, I didn't get a pump on that one. Well, it's probably because now you've adapted and it's just, you require more mechanical tension now.
Well, and the other one was another question I got is like, okay, you talk about mechanical tension and progressive overload and these different principles. Like, how do I, you know, progressive overload's easy, mm-hmm. right? It's add weight or add a rep, but you have to track. What about mechanical tension? And the easiest way for me to spot it is the speed of the movement, bar speed, mm-hmm. right? Like if all of a sudden you're, you know, four reps and they all look about the same speed and then the fifth one, there's like, you know, slows down and drives through, that's mechanical tension.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, add one more rep and you're going to work to failure. Now, if the weight's heavy enough, we don't necessarily have to work to failure. We can, you know, the margin of error increases. So I can, you know, if it's six reps and I get five, we're pretty good. Now with the super lightweight, now all of a sudden, like if you don't work to true failure, then you're not actually driving adaptation the way that you want. But also, you know, I think it was Paul Carter made a good point too. We were talking about diet. Mm-hmm. He's like, how much muscle do you think a person can put on a certain day, in a day? And I was like, I don't know, like a few grams? He's like, yeah, it's pretty small. If you think about like, you know, if you were to put a pound of muscle on in a month over 30 days, like if you look at what a pound is, you know, in terms of ounces, like, you know, break that down. I mean, if you were to put a pound on, you break that down, I mean, it would be what, you know, X amount. It's just very, very minute amount. Like how many calories do you need to really drive adaptation? And that was kind of an interesting piece because I always thought that, you know, you would need to be in a caloric surplus, but I think it's only a small amount, you know, maybe 100 or 200 calories. It doesn't have to be like we were doing it where it's like, hey, if your, you know, maintenance is 3,000, you need to eat 6,000 calories.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is that people get a little too cavalier, especially in that diet phase. You know, one of the other interesting things when we talked about Hammer 90 is that we found that the people that were the leanest were the people that put on the most muscle. And that's something that you found in yours. Mm-hmm. As you got dramatically leaner, your ability to put on muscle increased from the fact that there wasn't necessarily as much systemic inflammation from body fat.
Yeah.
And just some of the other driving factors. But I think that progressive overload, whether it be in jiu-jitsu, whether it be in lifting weights, whether it be in life or, you know, accepting new challenges. Hey, this is the challenge I did last time. Let me find a slightly bigger challenge.
Yeah. I think nutrition isn't optional either. I think that's another piece of the training that I found because I always had the ability to bring intensity to my training and I actually craved it. It almost was like a, maybe not so much anymore, but it used to be a huge mental outlet for me. Mm-hmm. Like I'm going to go in here and destroy the weights. I don't feel that way anymore.
Do you think that, I also wonder too, if, something that I've observed of you that I think I told you, like the day that all of a sudden, like the outside started looking like the inside.
Yeah.
I think that there was a disconnect. Like you had this light inside, but like physically you didn't feel like you were, you know, it didn't match.
Yeah.
And, seeing the confidence increase for the fact that finally like the outside was matching the inside. And I sometimes wonder if like a little bit of that was like you with the chip on your shoulder, like I'm going to prove these people wrong.
Yeah. In fact, I didn't want to be found out, which was, I didn't want people to find out that I actually wanted all these things. Odd as it is to say, it's like, I don't want you to be able to figure me out because once you figure me out, then you put me in a box and you know, I'm not like anybody else. Right. Mm-hmm. But in reality, what did I actually want? I wanted to have like a body that moves freely. I wanted to look good and feel good about myself. I wanted to be able to approach anybody, You know, I also want to, I want to play with the other kids, and you know, the other kids run around much faster and get way less tired than I do. And I think, you know, even as an adult, that's always something that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to stay in more shape than I was the year before so that I could beat masters jiu-jitsu athletes, right? So it's like, yeah. I was joking at Kate the other day because her and her ladies were, you know, doing their little I am the storm, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm over there on the Echo bike and I was like, hey, Kate, can you get a video of me? She was like, yeah, sure, doing your bike sprints. I was like, yeah. And then on the video, I was like, I'm just staying in shape to beat up other 30-year-old dudes. Like, but it's the reality is like, I just wanted, there were some things that I wanted that were super basic, but I felt ashamed of what I wanted.
Sure.
So I think training a certain way, I use that as an emotional outlet to be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go after this very obscure thing. I'm not going to tackle the thing that's actually in front of me, which is stop eating so goddamn much. Right. It's so funny. Cause I started teaching this, enrichment class in, at the Lake Travis ISD schools, like we give them like some a modified version of our kids class, and I feel like kindergarten cop. I'm like, sit here, don't move. We are here to make your body and your mind strong. Like it's.
I put the
cookie down.
I was laughing at you brought up Kate's program, I Am the Storm, and where that comes from is, you know, the quote, like the devil whispered in my ear, "You're not strong enough to withstand the storm," and. The quote is, I whispered back, I am the storm.
No, I never heard that.
Yeah, so it's a phrase. It's, I don't know, it's a mantra for resilience, right? So it's just like kind of encouraging, but like it's a motivation. You'll see it like periodically in, you know, shirts or bumper stickers, whatever. And the way it goes is the devil whispered in my ear, you're not strong enough to withstand the storm. And then you whisper back, you know, and then she goes, I am the storm. So when Kate said she wanted to call it I Am the Storm, all I could think of was one of the funnier bumper stickers I've ever seen. Was the same thing where it goes, the devil whispered in my ear, you're not strong enough to withstand the storm. And I whispered back, I love your eggs. So,
devil's eggs.
So when she pitched me this deal for the name of her program, all I could think of is, I love your eggs.
Gosh.
And I did not bring that up to her, but fact that, you know, I think I've been married too long. I don't think she thinks anything I say is funny anymore.
No.
Yeah. And then the funny part is, it's like Jamie, Killy, and Kate think nothing I say is funny. Cash is over there fucking dying laughing. Yeah. He's like, Dad, you are the funniest. And I'm like, see, I got one. That's all I need is one. And the girl's like, you're not funny.
What a sweetheart Cash is, man. Yes, every time he comes to jiu-jitsu class, he's always helping somebody out. And he's like, no, what you have to do is, and then he's like moving kids' hands around to teach them the Americana. It's... Man, what a gem.
He's a good kid. And I told him today, I was like, or when I asked him, like, how'd jits go? He's like, oh, and I'm like, dude, he's like, oh, I was rolling with somebody that he said they had tan belts.
They're gray and white belts. They're just darker.
Okay.
They just come from another school.
Yeah. So he was like, oh, I was rolling with these kids. And I was like, how are they? He's like, all right. I'm like,
dude. Was he stronger?
I asked him, I'm like, Cashy, one of the rites of passage in jiu-jitsu, if there's new people, you smash them. You do not do them any favors by being nice to them.
Brother, this is not TFI.
I was like, this is Six Blades. This is Shanji Jiu-Jitsu. I'm like, oh, new people? You know what you do? You smash them. So like one of my favorites was when I was going super consistent, obviously before the knee. But like there were some visitors. Yeah. And I forgot where they were from. Maybe they were like Australia or something. So the visitors come in and I was like, oh, Shanji, we got some visitors. And he's like, yeah, you know what this means. And I'm like, what? He's like, you know, you have to smash them, make them remember their experience. You don't do them any favors by holding back.
Yeah.
And I was like, so, and he was like, full tilt is what I said to him. And I ended up, dude, stack passing this dude. Oh my God. I stacked him and then I stapled his leg and I could feel his adductors and the dude tapped. Tapped off of a stack with the fucking staple.
Oh man.
And then that's when I realized that the actual kryptonite of dudes over 30 is external rotation and like not having that hip mobility.
Yeah.
And that's when I went back to you guys and that's when we started doing all the manual resistance butterfly and started putting all that stuff in. Kate and her ladies were struggling with a bunch of that stuff too. And I was like watching her do a bunch, like all of these movements and I'm like, dude, like manual resistance butterfly. We already know this, but that's a big problem too, because I can't tell her anything in the training space, which is
I would say it's that, and it's also movement variability. I mean, like watching kids on the playground now, they literally, the way they jump up and land on stuff, and you watch their hips, their pelvis tilting, they're moving, you know, all planes of motion, sometimes like literally falling in all planes of motion, just like little spaghettis. And then we get to these adults who are like very rigid, and they stay in the sagittal plane when they exercise, you know, whether it's a stationary bike or, you know, CrossFit, where we're just squatting, or we're doing pull-ups in one plane of motion. I mean, in reality, fitness is really what I found about fitness. And, Dr. Ben Skutnik and I were, talking about this, is, in relation to cardiovascular training or aerobic based training, is that it's easier to measure fitness, right? When you have weights, when you have movements that are clearly defined, right? It's important to do those things, but it's also important, as we were talking about earlier, to take chances and move in different ways that otherwise we don't move. So like playing games, like I think the best one for most adults to get started with is, what's that trampoline ball people play?
Smash ball. Yeah.
That's probably one of the best ways, 'cause you're literally moving around variably, you know, just with in all different kinds of directions, coordinating with the ball. That's probably a really good way. Like in addition to your fitness, play an open-ended game where your eyes and your neck and your back are all moving in different directions.
We used to play smash ball in the mornings as a warm-up. We used to put the deal. We used to have one in there and play smash ball, and the guys loved it.
Now here is the man himself, Jay Cutler.
We talked a little bit about the training. It was like never less than 12 reps and, you know, short rest periods, 30, 60 seconds. How long would each workout really last, and what was the split that you used? Was it one body part a week, two body parts a week? Like, how did you necessarily attack it? And like, what was the volume? Were you tracking volume, total sets? Or how did you necessarily get to where, or was it to the point where I was like, fuck, I can't do anymore, I got to go?
Yeah, so I did, like I said, I did everything at 12 repetitions, like four sets of each exercise. So if I was going to do a flat barbell press, I would do that four sets, then move to the next one. I would do probably six different exercises. So I would do 20, 25 sets per body part. That would take me, because of the short rest time, 45 to 60 seconds. I mean, I could get through that in about 45 minutes. And I was probably in the gym, I would say an average of an hour, especially like I mentioned, I was training twice a day. So I would do sometimes two body parts a day. So say I did in the morning, I went and did chest. I would, you know, rest 5 hours, and then I would go back and train like triceps. And that might only take me 30 minutes because it's a smaller body part, but I would still do 20 sets or, you know, 25 sets depending. My split was always usually 2 days on, 1 day off. So I did four weight workouts over 2 days. So I would always need a day off. So it's a miss. People think that bodybuilders train 7 days a week. We actually need rest days to recover. You're going to grow outside the gym. And that's why the diet is so important around the training. If I wasn't eating the meals, I just wouldn't train. Like say if I had a family emergency, or I got stuck on an airplane, didn't have food with me, and I ate twice in one day and I was scheduled to train, I wouldn't train that day, because it's not beneficial. You're not going to have the workout, the performance, you're not going to have the recovery. It's better to just take a rest day. So those days happen, but you have to stay consistent with it. And that's why, like, I had that schedule, 2 days on, 1 day off training. And I might, you know, I would do back one day, legs one day, say chest and triceps, and, you know, I'd do shoulders and biceps another day. So it was about five total days a week I was in the gym for weights.
Well, I wanted to get in. We sent you some questions earlier before the show, and I want to get into the importance of having an adversary. And did that help you to motivate you? Were you friends alongside Ronnie? Or was it this extra spark that really kept you going when the days got dark?
Yeah, I mean, I always wonder, like, I mean, it's kind of interesting as you go through your history and you look, I mean, it's kind of intertwined with this battle with Ronnie Coleman. And I always think that, like, there's probably great bodybuilders, but they don't have that individual that's pushing them, so they're not necessarily remembered you know, and so how did that part play into it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, he was my idol when I came into this. I mean, Ronnie Coleman called me when I won my first pro show, the 2000 Night of Champions, and he was the Mr. Olympia at the time. He had already won two titles by that point. And he was my idol, man. So he called me and, you know, he's congratulated me, not knowing that a year later, 2001, we'd be battling 1-2. I mean, I don't think he expected me to come up that quick. And, you know, from then forward, we traveled together. We spent a lot of time, and I would watch his videos and I would look at his magazine articles, and, you know, no one trained like him. No one was built like him. So you couldn't do it. You know, you idolize those people, but without Ronnie Coleman, I wouldn't have been great. I mean, I never would have pushed myself. I wouldn't have had the drive to be better. I don't think, because when someone is chasing you or consistently, or just, you know, is better than you, which at the time he was, that's what really kept me motivated. And, you know, I owe a lot of credit to that rivalry, but we were friends. But I'll tell you, I went in the gym like I hated Ronnie Coleman, you know. I would train like that every day, and I would truly believe that every Mr. Olympia that I battled him, I was going to win. And people thought I was crazy about that, but there's no way you can prepare fully and correctly if you're not like, you know, I'm going to win this contest. I never thought about defeating or accepting second place or, you know, 15th or 8th, which I finished prior. Like, I only wanted to be the best. And, you know, I try to create that environment around me and have people around me that believed in me, but didn't over accentuate the fact of how great I was. So I would fly people in and out to train with me. I would mimic a lot of things that Ronnie did in his videos or his workout routines in the books. Because, listen, it worked well for him. Heavy training, you know, T-bar rows, for example, to increase my back deadlifts, which I didn't necessarily do through my whole career. I was able to incorporate those things, and that gave me motivation. So I would hope he would feel the same way. I mean, me being second consistent to him, I'm sure kept him on his toes. And I truly believe he knew he was the greatest at that time and probably never thought he'd be defeated. And, you know, I was one of the fortunate ones to be able to do that. But at the same time, I always mentioned I kind of felt bad beating him in 2006 when I won the title, because I idolized him so much and I respected him so much. And I knew how much he loved bodybuilding. Like I said, we traveled a lot of weekends together. We did guest appearances together. That's what was so cool, is the magazines built us up as such rivals. But we had so much fun on the road together. You know, we'd go out to the clubs and we'd eat to dinner together, and we would train together. And we had a lot of laughs, and you know, those are memories that I don't think will be replicated, because there's not that consistency 1-2 competition anymore. And I don't think the guys travel like that for guest appearances as often because of social media. Like, everyone has their own YouTube or, you know, doing stuff on Instagram or TikTok or whatever else, these platforms. But, you know, it's definitely changed the landscape of what, you know, the guest appearances of bodybuilding is.
Well, I think the social media has given rise to, you know, before you would have these individuals that had to go prove themselves and, you know, win something and be significant to be on the cover. Now it feels like anybody with a camera training in a gym can be, you know, as big as they need to be. Are you a big TikTok guy?
Yeah, I actually do a lot of TikTok.
Okay.
I got a great community on there, and I do a lot of instructional stuff on TikTok. So I know it started off as like people dancing and music and,
yeah, I was wondering what's the Jay Cutler dance?
Yeah, so a lot of my stuff's instructional. So I say, hey, this is a tricep push down. This is how I do it. This is a technique, and this is the area it builds. So a lot of mine's instructional, but yeah, there's some funny stuff on there. I do some, you know, I was dancing, you know, in the gym. I had, you know, my fiance kind of rubbing up on me while I was trying to get serious about a set, and people like to see that stuff. I mean, the most popular TikTok is my quad stomp challenge. So basically, I'm known as 2009. I came out and I hit my leg and it had all these striations on it. So I kind of recreated that and I said, let me see your best, you know, quad stomp video. And, you know, people tried to mimic that. It's very, very popular now, especially as time goes on, like the Jay Cutler quad stomp, because I came out there and shook the stage and, you know, I had crazy striations. That's one thing I was known for, is the striations in my leg. So, people try to mimic that. Even today, I'm looking at, you know, these guys on stage competing in these shows the last few weeks have tried to replicate the quad stomp, but you know, I'm the original quad stomper.
Do you think that they're doing it justice?
You know what? No one's going to top my quad stomp.
What, I'm always interested when, cause this happens in football. It happens in professional sports all the time where people look at different eras and think like, and they argue whether or not Wilt Chamberlain could play in that era. And the same thing happens in football where, you know, but you have a guy like Tom Brady, who's now had like four, you know, Hall of Fame careers. So it's like the guy can play in any era. What about in bodybuilding? Like, when you look, I mean, obviously you'll see pictures of Arnold who, you know, you look in like your era and others, you know, even though the physique was still very impressive, like you see this evolution. I wonder, because we were at the Olympia this past, you know, what was it, a couple weeks ago. And it just curious to know, like, as you sitting back looking at it, having done that, like, what's your impression? Does Ronnie Coleman step on and you step on in any era and win, or is it evolved? Has it changed?
I hate comparing it. You know, it's kind of, I'm kind of like LeBron MJ comparison. I'm sure they both can't stand it. And how, the truth is let's be real. I mean, I'm going to tell you as a four-time winner, if you said, okay, tell me who the greatest bodybuilder of all time is, I'd say Ronnie Coleman. If Ronnie Coleman competed in any era, he would beat all these guys. There's no question. But who would be the second guy that would, you know, dominate like that? And I would probably say, you know, Lee Haney or Dorian Yates, or, you know, and Phil Heath is another guy. I mean, we don't really talk about him because he's still fairly new and winning his seven titles. And I mean, I just think that, you know, there's, everyone has their own place, and I hate to make those comparisons, you know?
I know. That's why I asked you. Because people do hate it. And like, it's why Michael Jordan put out the whole, the last dance. Yeah. The Last Dance deal. Was because he felt that motherfuckers were forgetting who he was, and like these other guys with social media, and he put that out specific because he wanted the next generation to remember.
Well, exactly who he was. I think he was more threatened by they started calling LeBron the GOAT, right? And I think that's really where Jordan said, "Hey, let me show this new generation. I'm here. We are." It was what 18 years later or whatever that he had a show. Hey, this is what went on, and you missed it. And listen, I'm thankful I got to see the Jordan era. I mean, I had the Jordan, you know, poster on, you know, on the wall. And I remember the first day the kid came in fifth grade with the Air Jordans on and thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe this kid, number one, can afford these shoes. They were $100. But I remember seeing and I have those original Jordans, you know, I have a ton of Jordan ones, but no one will ever do what he's done. Like he's the GOAT. There's no one that's going to brand like him, or I don't care what anyone says. I mean, he set that tone, right? But bodybuilding, I mean, to go back to that, I mean, we all have our eras, and Arnold's the king. I mean, let's be real. Arnold's just, he took this thing to another level. And that's what impresses me more, is like what Arnold was able to do after bodybuilding and, you know, still to this day influence people the way he has. Like he's still influencing people, which is crazy at 74 or 5 years old.
Yeah, no, I mean, he got to be governor, he was, you know, movie star, then he got into politics. I mean, the way he extended it was pretty amazing. Yeah, I don't know if anybody's necessarily done that.
It's not everyone's goal, but, you know, listen, bodybuilding only paid basically nothing back then. It was $500, I think, for the winner, where today it's $400,000, which in standard, it's not a ton of money for being the greatest at what you do. But, I mean, at my peak, I won $200,000. That was the most I ever won. So it's double what I ever was able to win. And, you know, we never cared about the money, to be honest. I mean, it was more about the elite title because you could do so much with that. And to this day, I'm still benefiting off what I was able to achieve on that stage.
Do you still do a lot of appearances and travel around?
Yeah. Tons. I mean, COVID sidelined a lot of FaceTime. The next scheduled one actually is around the 21st and 22nd, it's in San Diego. And of course, there's a lot of restrictions there with the vaccines. So I imagine the limitation is going to be a little less, but it's kind of nice. My international things, we're very, very big overseas. And but I get a lot of requests. I mean, already 2022 is looking to be a pretty busy year. And you know, I'm active on social every day. So I'm just doing a ton of YouTube. You know, I have a podcast and I do you know, stories through the day. And like I mentioned, the TikToks, the snap, I'm on everything, Snapchat. Still trying to be like 25, you know, acting up.
It's fucking overwhelming. Like I remember I got invited to go to a charity event and for Steve Weatherford, who's fucking punter. Oh yeah, you know Steve. Yeah. And he like comes over to me and he has like three phones and like one's his Snapchat this and he's like trying to like thank me, but yet he's like doing this whole thing. And I remember being like, fuck, dude, like I don't have the wherewithal to be able to handle this much like social media influence, or more importantly, allow the people to have this much access into my life. And I was like, okay, cool. And he was like off like by himself in the corner. And I'm like, man, it just felt really overwhelming.
Yeah, he actually does quite a bit on social media. But it's an era that some of us grasped and some didn't. I think, you know, letting people inside your life is something that really made me very successful. So I had DVDs, which were my early social media. People don't even talk about DVDs anymore, but Ronnie and I would have these DVDs and we would film in our off season or preparation for these shows we release every year. And that's how we let people inside, like, hey, this is the person I am. This is what I do. This is what I drive. This is how I eat. This is how I live. And that really gave people that insight and let people follow you. And then of course we were able to adapt to social, which, you know, in 2012, I made that transition when the magazine started to die off. And, you know, that's just, it's been the opportunity to really kind of interact with your fan base and, you know, and motivate people. And the really cool thing about what my career has given me is beyond all these accolades you see in the room here, hey man, the motivation, like the mail I get every day and, you know, the messages saying, I picked this up and I got this from you, or, you know, I'm motivated by what you do. So I feel obligated now to post out the media to keep people. Some people wake up every day and say, I wonder what Jay's doing. Let me see what he's doing. And if they see me on the treadmill or the stairs or whatever, they're like, man, I got to get my ass on there. So that's what's really cool about what we've done and what we were able to achieve, to have that influence, the positive things in people's lives.
Did you ever get the opportunity or the call from, let's say, a Stallone to make an appearance in Expendables or any feature film?
You know what? I was working on, this is a cool story actually. So 2009, I won the Mr. Olympia back. I had lost the title a year prior to Dexter Jackson. And I was approached by a producer that was working on the Hercules script, okay, which ended up, The Rock ended up doing later. And I was presented this. I actually got to meet with Stan Lee. Right. I mean, I got a face-to-face meeting, Lionsgate. Like, we talked about, you know, putting this film up. We had a budget of, I think, $23 million at the time. And the budget kept going down and down. And, you know, at the time I was massive, you know, I was, you know, 270, 280, and I would have had to slim down a lot. And the thing ended up getting canned, but I had that unique opportunity. I mean, I got to see inside like Hollywood a little bit. And then eventually, of course, the movie came out and I think The Rock did it or whatever. But, you know, it's just, I never had that opportunity where I wanted to pivot to that, because bodybuilding was so successful for me. But I'll tell you guys, the early influences I had were Sylvester Stallone and Jean-Claude Van Damme. So Rocky IV was like a movie that motivated me. I think it motivated a lot of people. And Bloodsport. And I thought these guys, because they were cut, they were so jacked, right? I mean, the TV makes them look so much bigger. And little did I know that Stallone was like 154 in Rocky IV, believe it or not. And, you know,
they had to have him stand on a box. So they had Rocky standing on a box. And, God, I watched something on it. Because I'm always amazed by Dolph Lundgren. Like, the dude's like, he's got like a PhD in like rocket, like he's such a fucking interesting dude. But when they brought him over and they were doing the stuff, they have Stallone standing on a box. Cause what's Stallone like? 5'7", 5'8". And he's like 155 pounds. And what's, you know, Lundgren's 6'4".
Yeah.
So it's fucking hilarious.
So
Google says 5'10".
Those were my guys. And I can tell you, I was able to meet both of them. I actually just ran into Jean-Claude not too long ago, about a year ago. It's on my YouTube channel. But so Stallone in 2004, he had a supplement brand, and I won my third Arnold Classic. It was Schwarzenegger's show in Ohio. And I remember I was walking into Morton Steakhouse, and a guy came running over to me. He's like, hey, I've got someone that wants to meet you. And I walked over to a limo, and out steps Stallone, and he goes, hey, Jay, I'm a huge fan. And I was like taken back, because at 12, I was watching Rocky IV, being like, oh my gosh, like, so Stallone, he's so jacked, this and that. And little did he know, he motivated me so much. Same thing with Jean-Claude. I remember the first time I met him, I was, you know, established bodybuilder, I was walking across the parking lot, Gold's Gym Venice. And I see this guy, and the guy's saying, Jay. And he's walking from his car. And as he gets close, I'm like, oh my goodness, that's Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he's like, puts his hand out and he says, Jay, I'm a huge fan. So for me, coming from Massachusetts, town of 6,000 people, never thinking I was ever going to leave that place. You know, I'm youngest of seven kids. Like, man, I'm here in California, or, you know, I was in Ohio for the Stallone meeting. And, you know, Stallone invited me to go see The Contender. They were filming it in Vegas. I don't know if you guys recall, he had a TV show for boxing. And he invited me down after that. And, you know, we were able to, you know, be friendly some. And those guys, man, they motivated me. And, you know, to meet Arnold after watching, you know, Terminator. I remember seeing Terminator 2 in the movie theater. And that was like the day, I was 17 at the time. And I'm like, I am going to be a bodybuilder. Like, Schwarzenegger is the man. And like, all these guys motivated me. So it's crazy how those points in your life are motivation for the rest of your life. And then, you know, to meet your idols like that, you know, I've just had great opportunities to do that. And, you know, I've never forget it.
Here is a word from Antonio Squillanti.
I wonder if there's a relationship between intent and strength. Like, as you get stronger and you're in, is intent something that's taught? And more importantly, like, how do we teach that? Because I'm selfishly. But then also with rate of force development, like, once the athlete understands the intent, isn't the idea that you have to continually progress the implements or the weights or the percentages as they grow in terms of strength? Because you're not necessarily training these in a vacuum. They have to be in a concurrent training model. So I assume the athlete's getting stronger, also doing rate of force power development, and there's kind of a symbiotic deal between one and the other.
Well, you opened the door for a conversation that can take me for hours now.
Well, that's good. I like rabbit holes.
Let's go.
But I mean, you know, this is stuff. What's so cool about Power Athlete and what we do is we write programs for thousands of athletes. And the way it's set up through Train Heroic, I can collect data on all of these athletes. And they follow a very, you know, like, if I explained to you the template, you'd be like, oh, that's – and, you know, like, it's very easy for me to explain the template and really the hierarchy of programs. And, you know, the archetype for each program follows certain different training models. But the, you know, so that's what we do. But I'm fucking don't want to talk. So you go.
I beg you, please stop me if I go too long, because I can literally go for hours here. But I give my perspective on things, the way I approach this topic, I'm sure it's different for everyone. But the way I was brought up looking at strength training was all a question of, like, move more weight, move heavier things. Who cares if you move them slow? Just lift the bar up and be done with that. However, starting in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, something slightly different, something happened in the world of powerlifting, and that changed and that carry over to athletics as well. Fred Hatfield made a big effort to make people aware of compensatory acceleration training, or CAT, which is you can train. That's what people tend to misunderstand. You still can train very heavy, and you still can train as a power lifter. You can still eat 80, 85, 90% of your 1 rep max. The body's probably going to move slow, so your external velocity is not going to look that fast. The movement is going to be slow and grindy. But if you put the intent of moving that bar at the highest velocity you can possibly generate on the way up, your adaptation is going to get better, which means that over time, you're going to get much stronger than what you would otherwise be if you just applied that crazy amount of force at the bottom of the movement, and then you just free ride all the way to the top. And that's just basic biomechanics. And from biomechanics, you can prove that just by putting an EMG on the quadricep muscle or the glute muscle in a squat, you realize that they turn on a lot at the bottom of the squat, and then they slowly turn off as the movement progresses because mechanical advantage improves. So there are studies out there. I'm thinking about like Jones 1999 or other studies in the early 2000s, where they took two groups of American football players, so well-trained individuals, and they trained them. That was just for upper body strength. So same volume, same intensity, same frequency, same identical training load. The only difference was one group was not asked to move at a certain velocity. They just let them lift. The other group was coached in a way that they tried to get them to move the bar as fast as possible, as they possibly could on the way up. So the concentric portion of the movement. And again, you're not measuring the velocity. You don't care how far, how fast that bar is moving. What you care about is the intent of moving that bar fast. And one day, what they found after, I think it was like either 6 or 8 weeks of training, is that both groups, they equally got stronger. So their one rep max improved pretty much by the same amount. However, when they test them in a bench throw, so a more ballistic movements, the group that trained with no compensatory acceleration training only slightly changed their performance in the bench throw. The other group improved by more than 30% in the bench throw. And when they even broke it down between eccentric coupling time and concentric, their coupling time between eccentric and concentric decreased by a lot, which means that overall the rate of force development improved just by trying to move those weight faster. And there's another bunch of research done on a very cool topic, which unfortunately is not very popular in strength and conditioning, but it is in rehab, which is known as maximum intended concentric velocity. So there are different protocols that you can apply even in addition, where like by simply using intended high velocity, your level of adaptation will cover the entire spectrum from strength to power and rate of force development. And again, I want to repeat that one more time. The velocity at which you move the bar doesn't matter. If you're lifting 85% of your water max, if you're lifting 90% of your water max, inevitably your bar will move slow. But if you try to move the bar at fast as you possibly can through the entire range of motion, somehow you're still going to get more benefit out of it. If you want to even like bring it to the next level, you can throw in like an accelerometer and use velocity-based training, or you can put in bands and chains, which is known as accommodative resistance training, and that forces you even more to apply that constant velocity or increasing velocity on the way up and maximize adaptation. And if you look at the majority of meta-analysis published over the last 5 to 6 years. And I'm a big fan of chains and bands because I grew up with Louis Simmons. I used to love Louis Simmons at West Barbell. So I've done a lot of band work and chain work. But then if you were to compare results with like accommodative resistance training and traditional powerlifting training, when you look at sheer strength, there's no difference. You get stronger as long as you move big weights. But when you look at power, training with chains and bands does improve your power rate of development. So it is more athletic than traditional powerlifting type training. And that, to close the circle now, everything goes back to wanting to move that bar or being forced to move that bar as fast as you possibly can on the way up. Because athletes cannot be able to perceive whether or not they're moving fast. But the moment you put an elastic band on the bar, and if they don't move faster, the band is going to push them down. They need to learn how to move faster. And if on top of that, you provide that augmented feedback with velocity-based training, just by putting an iPad in front of them and having them see what velocity they're moving at, well, you're combining motor learning and you're combining physical development in just one. It's the perfect combination, I think.
Feedback goes a long way. I was thinking for Jamie, what about weighted box jumps?
I think the problem is she's just super skinny and she needs body awareness. So that inter and intermuscular coordination issue, like I think she doesn't know how to, she's so young, she hasn't wired up yet. So I think like, even though she might intend to move fast, she doesn't know how to make her body move fast. And the one thing that we found in just beginners with just basic barbell movements is that inter and intermuscular coordination and just almost that arranging of the body. And where now all of a sudden, like as strength improves, like that coordination effect, becomes so important for her in terms of like, okay, now I'm in this position, you know, because if you look at the hip angle, they're in kind of a staggered stance. The hip angle, they're bent at the waist. I mean, if she's standing up, it's, you know, maybe 75 degrees and then they bend over and then they have to almost flare and push off. Like I'm looking at it like, what if she just gets stronger with just basic, like a basic barbell movement, and then just teach her a little bit of plyometrics? I mean, it should go a long way. I mean, I think where people fuck up, you know, we get emails about this all the time, especially with kids, like the minimal dose for kids is like the maximal effect. Like if you could just get them to like do basic movements under load 1 or 2 days a week, you know, whereas, you know, like I saw a question the other day, some 20-year-old kid who's never lifted weights jumps into something like Jack Street. He's like, I feel like this is a little advanced. 100%. Like the reason that you're a beginner is because the simplistic principles and the basics are still very, very powerful. You'll get a laugh out of this. The old power lifter that trained me when I started, when I was with about 14 years old, was buddies with Fred Hatfield. And he used to talk about compensatory acceleration and the idea that we want to try to break the weights and his mechanical advantage improves, so does speed. So like when we would bench, you know, bringing the weight up and then trying to literally break the bar in half or trying to punch your hands through, you know, 2 inches so that when you go to punch somebody in football, you're not punching to their chest. You're actually trying to punch through them. Or the idea of, you know, coming out of the bottom and trying to vertical jump the weight out of, you know, through the roof. And so he used to always talk about, you know, like don't lift weights like old people, have sex, slow and careful, be violent, try to break those motherfuckers. And if you can break them, we'll go get new ones. And I think that training style when I was young, I've since slowed down a little bit. But when I was young, when I started lifting weights or when I went to go train, people would be like, dude, you're going to hurt yourself. And I remember thinking like, don't be slow and careful, be violent. And I think that ended up translating into, you know, 10 years in the NFL. But it was interesting when I got onto this coaching side, we were running a bunch of training programs and we went into this really interesting testing model. And I got all these results back and they were super confusing. Like I couldn't see any like common threads in them. And so I started watching the videos, and the thing that was universally true was that everybody was really slow and careful. And I ended up reaching out to Fred Hatfield, and we had a series of podcasts with him, especially the idea of like, you know, how he was able to generate force and that idea of intent, and then basically started programming that into all of our programs and talking about mechanical advantage increases, so does speed and compensatory acceleration, even figuring out like different percentages to try to teach people intent, more importantly, compensatory acceleration training. And I think that's been one of those things that is still so groundbreaking today, but yet people forget about it. And when I talk about it, like they, what are you talking about? What's this cat stuff? And, you know, the guys over at, you know, Gas Station Ready, like, they'll, you know, Josh Bryant, who we met, who was taught with Fred Hatfield, you know, he still really beats the war drum. Yeah, he still beats the war drum. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's something that nobody is really talking about, that idea of intent and trying to break those motherfucking weights.
I think it's almost universally true that if you learn how to train faster, you're eventually going to get stronger no matter what, when you're working with more like older athletes. I would just be a little bit more forgiving in kids or younger athletes, just because speed to some extent has a lot to do with proprioception. So how well you can feel your body moving in space. And when you're going through early puberty and you're body's growing so much and your levers are changing so much, and one day your leg is like this short and the following day you're super, super tall because you're growing, that proprioception like is skewed. And maybe they want to move faster. They just, they're not well in tune with their bodies yet.
Well,
but then after they're
like, does it matter? I mean, like as long as the intent is there, does it really matter how fast they're moving, as long as they're intending to move fast?
Yeah. Communicate the intent, then whether or not they're able to move faster or be super coordinated when they do it, just give them a little bit of like grace and freedom because they're still growing, but sure. Communicating the intent of moving faster, 1000%.
I can't remember if it was the Russian training manuals or Verkhoshansky's work, but there was some pretty detailed writing that I ended up calling it the priming the pump, where they had kids, like huge cross-sections of kids that they were putting in different athletic strength training programs pre-puberty, other kids they didn't. And then once they hit puberty, they were putting them into like a general training program. And they noticed that the kids that had done strength training or something that was more physically demanding before puberty gained strength and muscle at a much greater rate than the kids that didn't. And I can't remember if it was Verkhoshansky or it might even have been Dr. Romanoff might have talked about it as well in one of his talks, that idea of priming the pump. You know, and that's kind of why, like, for my kids, like, you know, like my daughter swims, which I love, just because the amount of like metabolic distress and conditioning that they do in the water is so high that like the metabolic pathways, I mean, you could never equate that out of the water. And so I remember years ago, Dave Spitz and I noticed that girls that had swam at a high level early on tended to gain muscle at a much greater rate later on. And I mean, we've seen like Colleen Fausch and some of these other girls that were high level swimmers. Once they travel over, start lifting weights.
China
Cho, another one, but end up putting on a ton of muscle. So that was why. And then, you know, just the fact that I love the fact that she can get out there and I mean, she can do it every day and they fucking go hard on those kids, like intervals, and they swim a ton. So, but have you seen anything like that or any research associated with that priming of the pump?
Yeah. A lot of it came from Carmelo Bosco in Italy too. He did a lot of work with the national track and field team, developing athletes all the way from the age of 6 to the age of like 21, 22. And I remember him always being debating whether or not this priming effect was physiological, like your muscles are just more responsive to training after you hit puberty, or simply by teaching them good lifting mechanics and good training etiquettes and train and teaching them how to be intense when they train, if that just exponentially increased the response after they hit puberty. Like, it was always questioning whether or not it was a physiological thing or just like a motor learning type of situation where like you just prepare that as soon as they hit puberty, they can already train at that level of intensity that they need to grow. So they're going to grow faster and get stronger. In my opinion, probably is a combination of both. But yes, it's fascinating. You training is a very fascinating topic.
Yeah, no, it's the one thing which has been really cool about, you know, all these advances in technology, especially like YouTube and whatnot, you'll see like clips of these kids, like little kids, like 7, 8, 9 years old playing football. And there's one kid who's just like remarkably different than all the others. And, you know, and they're, you know, they'll interview the dad and like, you know, the dad played professional sports or maybe played at a high level and the kid's just super focused. I always love whenever, like, kind of forget about it. And then I'm watching the playoff game with Joe Burrow, and they were showing a bunch of his high school and junior high and, like, you know, when he started playing football and his clips and how good he was. And they were like, you know, even when this kid stepped out, even at this young age, we knew that he was going to be special.
I don't know his story, but I'm in.
Well, he's awesome. Young kid in Ohio, they went and interviewed his high school coach. Who was like, you know, his football knowledge to the point where they were drawing up plays in the dirt during the game. And he's like, coach, I think this will win. And he's like, it was like having an offensive coordinator who was like 16, 17 years old on the field who understood it. And even they talked, what was the coach of Louisiana?
Coach O?
Yeah, Coach O said that when he showed up, he's like, he just wanted to talk about football and go eat some crawfish. That was it. He just wanted to rep football and eat some food. Like, didn't want to go out and drink or party or anything. Just let's talk about football and let's go eat some crawfish.
He's a big cigar guy.
You know what? I'm a fan. But I think what's cool today is that now we get to see this stuff and we get to almost tag these kids and then get an opportunity to see how they progress. But I definitely I almost wonder, like, what's the balance on that? Like, you know, you have kids that I played with who are high-level performers that end up burning out when they're 14, 15 and never want to play sports again. And then you have other kids who are just taken to it. Or like for me, I was kind of a late bloomer. Like, I didn't start playing football till I got to high school. And then, you know, I grew from 6 foot to 6'4 in high school and grew another 2 inches in college. So when I left college, I was 6'6. So, I mean, there's that kind of late bloomer, like J.J. Watt late bloomer effect, whereas some people have success early. I think you see both sides of this. And the one thing that's universally true, what he said, is nobody fucking knows. You can give somebody who have the, you know, the greatest genetics, greatest training, all the opportunity in the world. And if they don't have that little thing inside them to be, you know, to be great, it's impossible to teach it in the weight room and anywhere else.
I think you said a very important thing, like the little thing inside them. Ultimately, I think it's a question of, you can look at all the physiology of it. You can look at all the studies, blood works, whatever you want. But I think what really makes a difference for a youth athlete to either stick with sport, grow and get better, or quit, is whether or not they're intrinsically motivated to play sport and they just enjoy what they do and they want to do it better, or they're forced by their parents to perform in sport and compete in sports, which is extrinsic motivation. They just want to please them. If they enjoy what they do, chances are they're going to stick around for a while, for a long time, and they're going to get much better at the sport or their sports if they want to play more than one. If they have to do that, but they don't find pleasure in doing that, I think their career starts off in the worst possible condition already. Like, I think it's better for them to do less in terms of overall volume, do more in terms of activities, type of activities, but do everything because they enjoy doing it. If they have to be forced, I think their whole purpose of like embracing a career in sport like loses its meaning, you know?
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.